Welcome, everyone, to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker. Today, I'm joined by Eric Best, founder and CEO of Sound Commerce, a commerce data solution provider that helps brands realize profitable e-commerce business outcomes. With more than 25 years of experience as an entrepreneur and executive in the consumer direct and retail commerce technology market, Eric brings a tremendous amount of experience to the conversation today. Previous to founding Sound Commerce, Eric founded Mercent, served as chief commercial officer at Amperity, and held roles early in the development of Amazon's marketplace programs. I've known Eric for many years, dating back to our time at Amazon now many years ago, and know Eric as a husband, dad, swimmer, urban gardener, aspiring DJ, and long-distance target rifle enthusiast. Yes, Eric's a Renaissance man. It was great to have Eric on the show today to discuss the importance of driving customer experiences with data, composable commerce, and the future of retail as we live through this shift to generative AI. Enjoy the show. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us here on the podcast today. It's great to see you.
Hey, Brian.
We were just talking before we hit record, like how many years we have known each other in the Seattle tech community. The Amazon diaspora. It's probably, I don't know, approaching 20 years, something like that. It's crazy.
Just a few.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for being here today. We always lead with the same question here on the podcast, Eric. What was your first job or role that dealt with digital or e-commerce?
Yeah. Speaking of going back a few years, I had the great fortune of being an intern at Microsoft during my undergrad years at Seattle Pacific University here in Seattle. And I was there at the moment that Microsoft acquired an e-commerce shopping cart technology company called eShop. Uh-huh. And in hindsight, you look back at what these guys were building and doing, and it was so far ahead of their time. They had this poster for their brand. In fact, I think it was even part of their logo, and it was chopsticks in a takeout container. And their tagline was shop in your underwear. And they had literally built this, you know, a Gen 1 V1 shopping cart, and Microsoft picked it up and it became the foundation of their competitive product.
Was that Commerce Server? What was that?
It was called Commerce Server. Originally it was called Site Server and then later Commerce Server. And it was, yeah, it was sort of the OG competitor to ATG and of course IBM WebSphere back in the day.
Yeah. And then they ended up kind of spinning that out and it went through a number of different iterations even after that point. So it's still out
there.
This
is technology that was built in the 90s and it's still being used today.
Eric, you've been focused on data and commerce, of course, for many years now. And I'd like to hear how you think that the landscape has changed over the years, especially around data and how we use data inside e-commerce.
My experience this summer is relevant to the question. We attended and presented at Snowflake Summit in Las Vegas a few weeks ago. And more recently, we were at the LEAD show in New York, which of course focuses on the needs of direct-to-consumer brands. In the case of Snowflake's event, they had 12,000 attendees in Las Vegas. And it was two completely occupied exhibition halls filled with funded startups, system integrators, consulting firms. Deloitte was there. It's just incredible to see how vibrant the modern data stack community is. You look around, and I think if I were to summarize what I see today versus what I saw early on when you and I first met, the complexity and specificity of the both the business functions that brands have to address and the vendor ecosystem that supports those problems, those business functions, is just complicated. There are so many players providing so many solutions to so many of these specialized areas. I believe that in order for a brand to succeed today, you have to go deep to be successful. As it relates to data, you know, something as simple as a digital marketing attribution model can have multiple vendors addressing the problem. There's an entire data science built around that one particular function. On the other end of the business, if you think about something like routing orders from stores to the doorstep, that in and of itself is an entirely separate data-driven discipline. So you just look across that entire order lifecycle, you look across the entire shopper journey, and there are dozens and dozens of these functional areas that brands have to tackle to be competitive.
And bringing that data together is very challenging. What makes that so difficult?
Well, in some ways, I think it's getting harder because of this proliferation of data. I know we'll probably inevitably end up talking about generative AI. You think about the scope and volume of the data that is represented in these large learning models. It's kind of a parallel to the size and scope of the data that brands have to address today. On the other hand, we are seeing the rise of Snowflake and DBT and tooling that makes it easier for companies to embrace this complexity and volume. I think there's some very interesting things that are happening in terms of innovation around next generation data visualization. So in the BI space, companies that are emerging out of the Looker ecosystem or the Tableau ecosystem that are thinking about new and novel ways to address that. And then there's this whole world of data activation where, I mean, Bloomreach is a great example of a company that is helping advertisers and businesses take advantage of all of this data. So you have this explosion in the amount of data that's available to any given company. How do you discern what's important? How do you action on that data? On the other hand, you've got all of this incredible new technology that's coming about to help companies solve that problem.
And another huge issue is really just how do you normalize all these different signals coming out of different platforms in order to create a coherent view of the business? Or something as simple as you said, like marketing attribution. Which of these marketing campaigns and channels are actually contributing? Well, when you're trying to synthesize data from all these different sources and normalize it kind of against a single view, it becomes really challenging in today's landscape, right? And it can be a little overwhelming for organizations that frankly already have a lot to do just in running the business, let alone kind of problem solving all these different kind of aspects within their data, in order to then optimize on top of it. What are the common sort of data-driven mistakes that e-commerce companies seem to continually make? You're involved with customers all the time. You're obviously looking at their data kind of foundation, how they're looking to run the business, how they're bringing these different data sources together in order to provide that perspective. What are some of the mistakes that businesses are typically making, whether it's not paying attention to things they should, or over-calibrating on things that perhaps they shouldn't?
Yeah, I'll answer the question quickly in two ways. One is, we've already talked about the scope and complexity of the data. I think there is, in the pursuit of simplicity, practitioners often make the mistake of oversimplifying the problem. And there are an infinite number of examples where being too generic, too generalized in your approach to a calculation, a data set, causes significant issues. In the world of retail where we're focused in the data, there are nuances like the difference between the dollar value of orders that are converting in the shopping cart, which is a very important marketing signal, versus the dollar value of products that are leaving the data, I'm sorry, the warehouse, the physical warehouse, not the data warehouse. And that is the basis for how finance and accounting teams measure revenue. Something that simple, the fact that you have two different places where you need to measure revenue, can cause problems all over the organization. Fundamentally, the risk is that you end up with a mismatch in terms of shared understanding or lack thereof. You can look at any other example of that. Customer lifetime value. Is that a revenue metric or is it a contribution profit metric? Mm-hmm. And do we want cost of acquisition, our digital marketing expense, to be above the line or below the line? What do we do about discounts? What do we do about cost of goods sold, variable fulfillment costs?
Returns,
cancellations, partial shipments, when there's an out-of-stock item that's only one item of many in a cart. So all of these things conspire to make the details very important. And I think the second theme on your question is that there are really two ways to build solutions or buy them and assemble them, depending on your strategic approach. One is you start with a problem statement, and you work all the way backward to the data sources that matter in terms of solving for that use case. And the other way is you say, well, I have all these systems in play and I just want to collect all the data and land it somewhere. And we're going to have this massive asset that we can then use in creative and flexible ways in the future. I actually think successful organizations marry up both perspectives and marry up those approaches in a way that ultimately the business value for business decision makers, business practitioners is at the center of what's being built and how the data is being used. We will see projects often where the goal is to populate a data warehouse with a bunch of data, and there isn't necessarily clarity on how that information is going to be used by the business.
Or even what the definitions are often is a challenge. Exactly. Like, what does that actually mean? What does that metric actually mean? What's built into there and how should we be looking at it? Often I think that goes, in a sense, kind of missed in conversations about what it's going to take to optimize the business. Kind of a follow-on question. Do you see organizations now starting to look more at contribution margin and all these different inputs that are cost drivers versus only focusing on things like conversion rate, average order size, sales, or things like marketing metrics like cost of customer acquisition and lifetime value? Are you seeing like more of a focus on margin contribution?
Are you asking whether advertisers and companies have to return justify their investments and are no longer able to grow at all costs because capital is free? We've seen a profound change, especially in the last 9 months, in terms of the importance of that bottom line awareness, certainly among our customer base. But I think any company that was reliant previously on outside sources of capital to fund their operations, almost every business, I suspect, is being challenged by board and investors to get profitable, understand profitability, understand unit economics, the profitability of an individual transaction, the profitability of an individual shopper.
Just really simple examples just kind of illustrate this point. You know, there's marketing tactics like clearance sale emails, as an example, that can drive a fairly significant response, good open rates, good conversion rates, and revenue. But when you really look at the margin contribution of those kind of campaigns and those customers who are attracted to them, you may actually find that you're losing money every time you kind of rely on those types of campaigns because of all of the costs that you really need to factor into it. And when you factor in things like cancellations, returns, and so on, that's just a very simple example, but one that kind of illustrates the point, right? Meanwhile, there's a lot of other tactics that may seem like, well, they're not like juicing the revenue line in the same way, or conversion rates may seem relatively modest, but if you look at the profitability of those customers and those orders, that's really where you need to focus. And sometimes even the best customer, quote unquote, segment may be made up of some degree of unprofitable customers because of things like the cost around reverse logistics and all that. So these are just examples of the kinds of things that we're talking about. And obviously there's a lot of other aspects that can kind of be loaded in there.
I saw one statistic recently that 70% of acquired customers will never break even by the time you account for cost of acquisition and the cost to serve the customer, cost of goods sold and everything else that's involved, service costs. And so sort of like the old adage in digital marketing, you know that half of your campaigns are profitable, you just don't know which half. I think the same adage can be applied to your customer base, right? You know that 70% of your customers are not worth acquiring, but it's very hard to determine which 70%, right, to avoid and which 30% to focus in on. In some ways, it becomes much easier, right, once you have the relationship with the customer and you have early signals that can indicate their value and value potential over time. But it can be hard to guess at that initially with very little data to go on.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, aligning marketing and merchandising kind of perspectives on the reporting and the data you're using and what is the kind of version of the truth you're going to use is so important. Because if there is a disconnect between how the merchants are viewing the business and the categories and so on and how they're evaluating that versus marketing, you can end up with a very significant disconnect that can lead to really a missed opportunities all over the place. Whereas if you're really understanding even down to a category or item level, the performance, and then how that matches up to your key customer segments and drill into the profitability of those, that's really where the gold lies.
I'm sure this in some ways is self-serving, but I often describe retail as one of the most complicated businesses you can run. Back to your example of a clearance sale hitting a revenue metric, but completely missing a bottom line profitability target. The flip side is holding that inventory over time costs money too. And so many of these direct-to-consumer brands that were growing quickly through COVID and so on, you know, they are reliant on 3PL warehouses that cost for every, there's an expense not just for the pick and pack of every unit sold and shipped, but there's also a cost to just hold that stuff on the warehouse floor month after month. That's one consideration, is all of these operational nuances, complexities of the business kind of conspire to make that profitability very difficult.
Well, without making it a infomercial, Eric, I'd love to understand how you see addressing some of these challenges and in a sense, how you're approaching that at Sound Commerce, but also, you know, beyond that, how you think organizations should be thinking about this coming out of a period of like focus on growth and customer acquisition to now a focus on profitability and kind of sustainability of the business. How should businesses begin to think about this and start to lay in solutions that really can make a positive difference in how they understand and operate their business?
Yeah, I think if we talk about what the industry looked like when we started the company a little less than 5 years ago versus where we are today, it's profound the amount of change that has happened of late. This isn't just about generative AI or the metaverse or anything else that we've talked about over the course of the last few years. It really is around the rise of cloud infrastructure, the availability of useful cloud data tooling, the ability to pay as you go, sort of like the original utility computing, cloud computing phenomenon of 15 years ago. We had early adopters that realized that they could save money, at least at lower scale, lower volume, relative to having to build out raised floor data centers and run their own hardware and all of that. And now we're seeing the same phenomenon today with data infrastructure. When I started Sound Commerce, our original thesis is that we were going to build an entire end-to-end data pipeline, data workflow for the retail industry. And what's happened over the course of our history as a company is that we've seen this massive proliferation of point solution providers at every step along that data flow or, you know, data workflow. And so what that has forced us to do in response is to get very crisp about what we are trying to accomplish for our customers and kind of pick our lanes and pick our battles, if you will. And the thing that I would say is pretty universal in terms of how data is being adopted and used is that it is almost inevitably marketing led. And you see the CMO, you know, she's kind of the spiritual ambassador of that digital transformation initiative that's happening within a company. But oftentimes it kind of ends there. What we have always tried to do from the beginning is think about data as an asset and data as competitive advantage beyond marketing use cases and simply customer activation. And the way that that plays out in retail is you've got your marketing campaigns. You're thinking about who your customer is, how to retarget them, how to engage them and activate them and so on. But there's all these other data considerations that come into play. And you've already alluded and mentioned some of them. You know, my product assortment, inventory availability by store and warehouse, my retail merchandising calendar. If I'm Nordstrom and my half yearly sale is coming up or my anniversary sale is coming up, how does that impact my marketing strategy? Store footprint. The order life cycle, how many orders are on time versus late, as we described earlier, how many of those orders are getting canceled because there was some operational exception, how is that going to impact customer experience and in turn, customer lifetime value, repeat purchase propensity, and so on. To summarize, as we've seen data warehouses like BigQuery and Snowflake emerge and capture market share, I think the reason they've done that is because there's inevitably always some other data set that needs to be added to the mix that needs to be dimensioned out to support some new use case that we hadn't thought about when we started this cloud data initiative 3 years ago. Two other quick examples. We already talked a lot about the importance of profitability, but often those marketing systems are aware of revenue impact, but not necessarily bottom line impact. And then you can kind of characterize like the conversion event, the purchase made by a particular customer. That's not the end of the story, although it's sometimes viewed as such by marketing technology, but it's really the beginning of the order lifecycle. And it's an opportunity for companies to use data to be prescriptive in terms of how they serve that individual consumer. And that's where I think there's a lot of interesting innovation happening. You know, I know you, Brian. Should I upgrade your shipping preemptively because I know you're a high value customer? If I know your order is going to be late because there was some delay in our fulfillment center, based on my awareness of you and based on my awareness of the cost of that expedited shipping, should we preemptively move you into a higher shipping class? Those are the type of operational questions that I think are very interesting that go beyond the marketing domain.
What I like about that example is it's customer centric. This is about taking care of the customers we care about and making sure that we're focused on driving profitable outcomes over the long term by doing so. And really, you know, thinking about the use cases from a customer centric perspective, I think is a great way to start and can kind of get a whole organization to kind of focus on, okay, this is why we're trying to solve these sort of data integration challenges and use solutions to measure the business to understand it and then activate on that data in a way that is about communicating effectively with the customer in a relevant way. Switching back to AI. So you've mentioned that, and AI, of course, is a huge topic, and AI is not new in our industry, but of course, it's now being discussed in almost every discussion you're having in this market. What are some of the things you're most excited about when you think about the impact of AI or generative AI on the e-commerce industry, kind of from the lens of you know, the domain and use cases that you're focused on? What excites you the most? What do you think is the most interesting? And where do you think maybe we're overemphasizing the opportunity as well?
Yeah, I think when I see generative AI in the media, when I see conversations about it happening in our industry, the focus is often on user experiences. How do I automate my customer service bot? Right? Or how do I answer simple questions that you might have about this particular product without having to get a human involved and intervening? Or I see a focus on kind of the creation of content and creative to augment the work that might already be underway by a creative team or a product team within my organization. And we should differentiate between generative AI, which I'll talk about first, and then some of the other kind of more traditional machine learning opportunities that we're pursuing.
Yeah. But,
you know, I view the most exciting opportunity around generative AI as a solution to the most mundane and painful problems that exist, at least in our world, in the data space. And examples of things that we are just starting to experiment with now in a lightweight way at Sound Commerce, include things like, you know, when you are mapping data from source A to destination B, the traditional way to do that is to think about that as a structured data problem. I have a revenue field over here. I need to map to a revenue field over there. I have a profit field over here, maps to profit over there. If you can describe those data elements in verbose terms, in using plain language, then there is a means of automating much of that mapping and transformation of the data by running it through these large language models.
As you said, mapping how the data is structured in those systems has been, you know, something that developers and business analysts have been charging billable hours for many years. And as you said, it's not even really enjoyable work. Necessarily for many of them either. And even when you've got kind of an API-based integration capability, that work still needs to happen typically, right? In any kind of systems integration effort. I think we'll see, third-party tool sets that emerge, as well as companies such as ours leveraging these kinds of capabilities to streamline, speed up, and perhaps make it even higher fidelity process to integrate these systems.
Contrasting generative with predictive machine learning and so on, we've built our own algorithms that, for instance, predict the next most likely purchase that a shopper will make. We look at years of order history for an individual, and we try to make an assessment of what that individual will do next in terms of repeat purchases and so on.
Yeah,
I still think there's an opportunity to apply specialized algorithms to things like merchandising planning, inventory forecasting, demand planning. In the case of this example, the idea of forecasting the value of a customer or order volume, that sort of thing. Even maybe solving for where to put your next incremental dollar of advertising spend predictively. I will say, it seems like more and more of those use cases are going to be addressable through generative AI. I've seen some amazing examples of where you basically load a data set into the, you augment the training data with a decade's worth of customer order history, and you can ask plain language questions. What's my revenue going to be next month? What's the most popular product that I'm going to sell next month or next holiday or next year? And right or wrong, the system will come back with an answer to that question. So,
yeah, I think demand forecasting and demand planning and merchandising, there's a whole host of ways this will be improved. And I think even leveraging even the kind of existing reporting landscape is going to change dramatically, because now I don't need specialized skill sets. I say now, but I mean, in the near future, may not need specialized skill sets or knowledge in order to really query my data to get answers to questions like those. Of course, relying only on historical data has its limitations in a fast-moving culture and economy, but nonetheless, for example, just, the impact of influencers and the impact of memes on TikTok is so difficult for anyone to predict, right? TikTok itself can't really predict the impact of some of these things very effectively. And the impact that has downstream on assortments and inventory and so on, very difficult to necessarily predict. So while we can leverage this sort of historical view perhaps more effectively moving forward, it's still not going to answer all
right.
The questions.
Chaos theory.
Which is why you need agility, right, to respond. So there's absolutely an opportunity to leverage AI to drive that kind of intelligent signal so that you as a business person can make, faster decisions. And if you have the agility in your systems to respond, it's a bit of an inflection point in even how businesses are structured and operate, leveraging these kinds of tools to speed up and become more agile.
And I know it may sound pedantic, but all of that capability is really dependent upon this idea that we understand the data that we're using, right? And that data that understanding is shared across the organization, and it's detailed enough, it's specific enough to address the use cases that you're describing. If I'm going to talk about logistics complexity, right? If I'm shipping onesie, twosie doorstep deliveries to consumers using international air freight, I better know what I'm doing in terms of that order lifecycle and that customer relationship and all of the operational decisions that are upstream of that moment.
Well, it's a huge topic. I know we're going to keep talking about, the impact of these kinds of capabilities and tools. It's very early days. And I think vertical specific solutions that, leverage large language models that are leveraging, this large cloud data set that many organizations have built up, and then taking advantage of these external signals, we're really early on, I think, in terms of understanding how to leverage these tools and the impact they're going to have. So obviously, we're going to keep talking about it. Mm-hmm. Perhaps an unfair next question, because we just talked about a very important theme that's coming. But Eric, we have a last question that we ask every guest on the podcast, and that is, what futuristic digital commerce innovation are you most looking forward to? Or alternatively, which innovation is overhyped and you think we should just stop talking about it because you think, you know, this is just never going
to
work?
When I look ahead to the things that I think are most likely to be disruptive, the area that is most intriguing to me, although it's quite set apart from the work that we're doing at Sound Commerce today, it's really around the physical automation of the industry that I'm seeing with, you know, multiple generations of robotics running in Amazon fulfillment centers and elsewhere. And then as I think about these electric vehicles, which are not yet self-driving, at, you know, set aside consumers in self-driving vehicles for a minute and just think about the impact that electric, robotic, self-driving delivery trucks will have when all of our FedEx and UPS and Amazon and other deliveries can be done between midnight and 8 a.m. And in effect, that business cycle becomes a 24-hour business cycle. Daylight and human intervention sort of becomes a secondary consideration. On the one hand, I think consumers become more dependent than ever on the system. Yeah. On the other hand, I think the workings of that become less disruptive to people. The deliveries happen at odd hours. The, you know, the trucks are not clogging up traffic during the morning and evening commute and rush hour and so on. And so as we move toward more of this physical automation, I think we're going to see yet another sort of generational shift change in terms of how reliant we are on, you know, some of these real-time logistics capabilities and how integrated they become into our lives. So I'm excited to see what comes next.
Well, Eric, thank you again so much for jumping on the show. It's great to see you again. I know we'll catch up over a cocktail or a beer in the not too distant future, since we're both in Seattle, although we tend to run into each other in other cities.
It's true. Noted,
over the years. It's either New York or Vegas. And we're like, why aren't we getting together in Seattle? Right. So we'll have to change that.
Got to do it more often. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in and share some ideas with you today.
And of course, on the podcast page, you'll find a way to connect with Eric and learn more about what he's doing over at Sound Commerce and my information as well. To all those dialing in and listening, thank you again so much for joining us here. We always look forward to your feedback and ideas for the show. Meanwhile, be safe, be well. Here's to good business.